I'm Jack Beatty. This is The Connection. Congress is in recess, but the special interest groups are hard at work, and none harder than the pharmaceutical industry. At a time when the health of many American businesses is failing, big drug companies are enjoying salubrious profits. Drug prices rose 10.5% last year, triple the rate of inflation, and the industry profit margin was nearly 20%, as against a 5% median for the run of the Fortune 500. And yet, the pharmaceutical industry is feeling anxious about the future. The public is angry over high drug prices, and there are battles looming with Congress over price caps and generic drugs. Armed with a $50 million lobbying and advertising campaign, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, the political arm of the pharmaceutical industry, commonly known as pharma, is ready to fight. Connection listeners, pharma says that price controls will kill the golden goose, the research you depend on for new disease-curing or disease-managing drugs. Do you buy that argument? Do you think the farmers should get their patent extensions, even though that'll keep low-cost generics off the market? Are you confident that Congress will climb out of bed with the farmers and serve the public interest? Make the pharma lobby connection this hour on The Connection. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. I'm joined by Darrell West. He's a professor of political science at Brown and the author of The Sound of Money, a book on the demise of the Clinton Care in 1994. He joins us on the phone from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome, Professor West.
Thank you, Jack. Nice to be here.
Glad to have you. The past is prologue, Darrell West. Let's turn the clock back to 1993-94, the last time the government was talking about expanding medical benefits. Clinton Care was on the boards. Bill Clinton was pushing Hillary Clinton's health reform plan. As late as the summer of 1994, polls showed that 80% of the public supported the linchpin, the central idea of Clinton Care, which was universal coverage for all Americans, health care that's always there for everyone. And yet, with an 80% approval for that, by the 6 months later, health care was dead. Some people think this was the most flagrant example of the triumph of private over the public interest in the post-war era. How did that happen? Who killed health care reform? Who killed universal coverage? How did they do it? And what are the lessons we can learn from that episode?
Well, the Clinton health care reform effort was a classic case of interest group lobbying. Certainly, there were big interests, the pharmaceuticals and industry and the insurance industry, that had grave concerns about what those changes would mean for health care in general, as well as their own particular interests. And so they both ran a massive advertising campaign. The insurance people, of course, did the famous Harry and Louise campaign that raised doubts about the Clinton health care effort, charged the bureaucrats would be in charge if this reform went through. And in the end, as you pointed out, they were able to stop this reform effort dead in its tracks, even though we had a Democratic president and a Democratic House and Senate. And since over the last 10 years, we've seen different skirmishes between the various interests trying to navigate this healthcare reform area.
And what was striking about that business was that, you know, if you had 50% public approval for something, you could understand how it would go down, but 80%.
Well, the problem with the Clinton healthcare effort is the public wants a lot of different things from healthcare, in the sense that they want the best drugs that are available. They want experimental treatments that can deal with the various ailments that all of us have to deal with in our families. And we want universal coverage. And so the public is essentially contradictory in the types of views that it endorses, and then that gives opponents an opportunity to pick out various aspects of reform and basically turn it to their advantage by trying to mobilize the parts of the public that are upset with particular aspects of a reform bill.
You mentioned the suasion of the Harry and Louise ads. Remind us of those, and then we want to play an ad being used this year. What was the scenario in those ads? Who was Harry? Who was Louise? And what were they saying?
The Harry and Louise ads were run by the insurance industry and featured an ordinary-looking couple sitting around their kitchen table, or in some cases in their living room, just talking about different aspects of the Clinton health care reform effort. And then slowly they would start to raise doubts about, you know, if we adopt the Clinton package, does that mean there's going to be health care rationing? Will the federal government take on a much greater presence in the health care industry? What would it mean for the average consumer? And those ads really resonated with a lot of people. Members of Congress got flooded with phone calls and letters, and in the end, Clinton's health care reform died without even a vote on the floor of the House or Senate.
Let's hear this ad this year.
When your daughter's first diagnosed with a life-threatening disease, you don't want to talk to anybody. Originally, we took her to the doctor for a sprained arm. The doctors thought it might be something else. That's when she was diagnosed with leukemia. I just kept saying, can't you run more tests? This can't be true. But it was. We thought we were going to lose Gianna. Then we got some hope. The doctor told us that there was medicine for her to try. Gianna tried it, and after 30 days, she started to get better. She's in remission. She's doing great. Thank God for these drug companies. 5 years ago, they wouldn't have had such success rates, where now they do. Her last day of treatment fell on my birthday. And I couldn't ask for a better present. I don't think there's anything you can say to them besides thank you.
Well, thank God for the drug companies. Tough stuff.
It is. This ad is a perfect illustration of how the healthcare area is a very complex and technical area, and it's a subject about which it's hard for many people to directly relate. And so what this ad does is to really personalize the issue, you know, bring it home to a family, a kid struggling with leukemia, and makes the point that you need the pharmaceutical industry to produce these new drugs. Now, of course, what the ad doesn't address is, you know, what the actual costs of drug production are, how long drug companies should be able to keep patents on major drugs, and at what point should generic drugs come onto the market that would lower the costs of prescription drugs to the average American. And that, of course, is the bone of contention in Congress right now, because the pharmaceutical industry wants longer patent laws. Certainly they want to avoid price controls, and they essentially want to keep generic drugs off the shelves as long as they can.
You're also a pollster. Is there any public opinion on these questions? Have you measured that, or public views about the drug companies?
Well, people are generally favorable towards the drug industry, because they do associate new drugs with solving illnesses and dealing with various healthcare problems. But as with any mega industry, you know, the public is quite ambivalent. We kind of want our drugs on the one hand, and we want, you know, the best and most recent medication that we can get. But on the other hand, you know, we want lower cost. And everybody's complaining about the high cost of prescription drugs. It was a major issue in the last presidential campaign. And Congress is now trying to struggle with how they can provide prescription drug benefits to ordinary Americans.
This advertising of drugs directly to the public like this is something relatively new. According to my research, it just came out in 1997. The FDA allowed this. And since then, spending on prescription drugs has gone up by nearly 20%. So these ads are not only giving political cover and for the drug companies, they're also inducing drug sales.
Yeah, there's no question this is a major change. And, you know, all of us have seen ads for Celebrex and Lipitor and, you know, Bob Dole starring in Viagra drugs. Mm-hmm. And this is a very new and recent phenomena. And the drug companies are spending so much money on advertising that critics raise the issue of, gee, you know, if we need to extend the patent laws in order to protect the medicine, the stream of new medicines coming on board, what are we really paying for? You know, are we paying for the cost of producing new medicines, or are we really paying for these expensive advertising campaigns promoting specific drugs?
Mm-hmm. Who are the sides in this year's debate in coming up in Congress? For example, over the patent extension? The drug companies want it extended, and there's a smaller lobby from the generic drug manufacturers. Is that so?
Yeah, I mean, you have the major drug companies who want to extend the patent laws, other companies that specialize in generic drugs that, of course, want to keep the patent laws basically where they are so they can get their generics to market as soon as possible. But then you have consumer interests who are weighing in, who basically face the dilemma of wanting both cheap and high-quality drugs. And that's really the contradiction that this legislation is having to address and try and figure out what is best for the consumer. How can we maintain the production of new drugs, but at a reasonable cost to the average consumer?
Now, this claim, of course, that you can't have both cheap and new is buttressed by a good deal of research. But on the other hand, there are people who argue, Ralph Nader's Public Citizen, for example, that the claim that research is, I think their claim is $500 million for to develop one drug, is wildly inflated, that it's more like $100 million, and that this whole the whole premise of the debate here is based on faulty research.
Yeah, I think that is really the nub of this dispute. The question is, what does it actually cost the drug companies to produce new drugs for leukemia, for a heart attack, for strokes, you name the disease? And particularly when you have the advertising costs that get factored in, you know, what is the cost of producing the drug and what is a reasonable rate of return for that industry? As you pointed out in your introduction, drug companies have had record profits for more than a decade. You know, their stock prices have generally done very well. They're making record profits, and it leads people like Ralph Nader to basically say they're gouging the consumer, that they simply don't need those record profits to keep maintaining the supply of new drugs.
What about the prescription drug benefit? What is the debate over that? What are the issues there?
Well, actually, both Republicans and Democrats in Congress, as well as President Bush, are in favor of some type of prescription drug benefit. The question is, how generous should it be, and at what cost to the taxpayer? That really has been the crux of that dispute, because we know that seniors are living on fixed incomes. There have been numerous complaints in polls and focus groups about the high costs of prescription drugs, sure. And so they need to find a handle on how to keep those costs down and then deliver those benefits to seniors.
And this is a real issue, the price of drugs, and one that looms over the future just simply because of the advance of technology and science. Last week, the Wall Street Journal had a shocking story about a man who, elderly man, put in the hospital in Duke for a severe and rare blood disorder. He spent 34 days there. The tab was high for spending the time there, but the tab, which was in the end over $5 million, was almost all for drug costs. This is extraordinary. We're in a collision course with science here between price and science. We're talking about the pharmaceutical lobby this hour on The Connection. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University.
This is The Connection. I'm Jack Beatty. We're talking about the power politics of the pharmaceutical industry this hour. My guest is Darrell West, professor of political science at Brown University. And we are joined now by Peter Stone, staff reporter of the National Journal and the author of the recent article, Pharma Fights Back. Also joining us is Wayne Pines. He's a consultant to pharma. Peter and Wayne, thanks for joining us. Peter, let's start with you. What are the stakes this year for the pharmaceutical industry, and what is the industry doing to try to make its wishes law?
Well, the stakes this year, Jack, are extremely high. The industry has taken a public pounding in the last few years, particularly last year when it worked to defeat the Clinton prescription drug benefit initiative. And as more and more seniors and more politicians have come around to supporting a prescription drug benefit. The industry has come aboard now and is backing a general benefit for a Medicare prescription drug benefit. It's trying everything it can to ensure that it gets the kind of benefit it wants.
What is that kind of benefit?
Well, basically, the industry has certain principles that it's come around to, that it's agreed on. The key one being that it wants to make sure that there are no price controls in any benefit and that it's managed by private health plans. They charged last year that the Clinton plan was a government-run system, a bureaucratic system. And indeed, last year, an industry-funded group, Citizens for Better Medicare, ran over $60 million worth of ads, which was four times the Harry and Louise campaign, to help defeat the Clinton plan. But they know now that they see themselves in the spotlight. They realize it's a popular issue, and they want, with Republicans in control of Congress and a friendlier, more sympathetic White House, they see an opportunity to develop support in Congress and the administration for a plan that would be privately run, private health plans, and that they feel more comfortable with. This is their key issue in Washington this year, and they're working on all sorts of fronts to achieve this goal, to help combat their negative public perception. They're spending much more on image advertising, education advertising, the kind of ad you ran earlier that talked about just how valuable life-saving medicines can be.
Education or propaganda, I guess you can take your pick.
Well, there's some validity to it, and I think that you don't want to demonize the industry. The industry has done some good things, too, and there are many drugs which are very important, and they have a story to tell. I think that, you know, there are concerns, obviously huge concerns, with the fact that spending on prescription drugs has soared almost 19% a year for the last couple of years. As you said earlier in your intro, the average price of a prescription is up 10.5% last year, which was triple the rate of inflation. There are deep concerns about prices, but the industry also does contribute, you know, important life-saving medicines, and that's the story they want to tell, and they want to counteract concerns about prices as much as possible. They want to emphasize how much they spend on R&D. Mm-hmm. This is an argument that can persuade people to think that, well, if they need all this, you know, if government price controls could curb R&D, which is sometimes what they argue, that this might be too risky a step. So they're working in they're working with image advertising. They're working with PR. They've hired PR firms, spending millions on new PR efforts in Washington to try to tell their story better to Congress.
And they've hired both Democrats and Republicans, former Congress people, to lobby.
Exactly.
And we can't forbear mentioning that they've even gone to some pretty extraordinary lengths. For example, Eli Lilly hired as its chief person for government relations. A woman who, according to the stories in California papers and in the American Prospect, was the lover of the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Bill Thomas, who's the key person on drugs in the House. This is called pulling out all the stops, isn't it?
Well, I think they're trying to cover all their bases every way they can. I mean, Deborah Steelman, who Eli Lilly hired, has long been one of the top healthcare lobbyists in Washington. She's got a stable of pharmaceutical clients before she went over to Eli Lilly, and she was an advisor to President Bush, and a healthcare advisor now to in the Bush campaign last year. She's very well connected, and reportedly she did have an affair with Bill Thomas a year or two ago. That has been in the press and raised a lot of eyebrows, obviously, that Lilly would hire somebody like that to help them win support from Thomas. Thomas has long been a big friend of the industry, though. There's no secret there.
Sure.
And the industry has lavished more political action committee contributions on Thomas than any other member of the House over the last 10 years or so. He's gotten $192,000 in PAC donations, leading all recipients of PAC money in the House. And his bill last year was one that the industry liked because it did provide more a bigger role for private health health plans to manage mm-hmm. the benefit. Mm-hmm. So he's a staunch ally. They've sure. got lots of other allies in Washington these days, too, obviously. I mean, sure. they have a former Eli Lilly executive is running the Office of Management and Budget. That's Mitch Daniels. Mm-hmm. Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, was a industry executive as well. The Bush administration is seen as very, very friendly and very sympathetic to the industry's concerns.
Sure, and ideologically friendly, too. It isn't just a matter of campaign contributions. Let's bring in Wayne Pines here. Wayne, we've been kicking your industry around. Why don't you kick back here at us? What's the case you all want to make?
Well, I think we have to go to the fundamental issue, and that is how does the American public that wants and needs drugs, not only existing drugs, but new drugs, gain access to them and do so at an affordable price? The industry for many years, not just in the last few months, but for many years has supported fundamental reform in Medicare that would increase access, favors expansion of the private insurance plans that probably everybody on this telephone and a lot of the listeners to this show have, and where we pay $5 or $10 a prescription. Two-thirds of seniors already have that kind of coverage. We're really only talking about bringing one-third of seniors under new plans. And so the industry has tried to be very, very positive in terms of its support for Medicare reform and for a prescription drug benefit. It does not like the concept of price controls. Price controls have never worked in any industry, and price controls, if they were to come in, would force the industry to look very carefully at its research priorities. I think that we all, as patients and future patients and as consumers, have a fundamental interest in seeing to it that we have a strong pharmaceutical industry, because the vast, vast majority of the research that's done in this country, and certainly virtually all of the development of new products, is done by the pharmaceutical industry. And if you cripple the industry, then what you're doing is you're crippling medical research. We can, you know, talk a lot, and you know, this conversation has talked so far about the influence that the industry exerts in Washington. What it's trying to do is not only to protect its interests, but also to be a strong industry. It's one of the few remaining industries in America that remains a world leader in terms of technology, and that is because it's been able to persuade members of Congress, persuade members of the public, that indeed the interests lie in having a strong pharmaceutical industry.
We have a call just on this question of research for you, Wayne. Pam is on the line. Hello.
I assume you went Tammy, but that's all right. Is that correct?
I see PAM on my...
About the funding question.
Yeah.
My question is, and I actually called even before this last comment, but I was wondering what proportion of the funding of research into new drugs actually comes from either government sources, whether it's funneled through NIH, through university research programs, and in some cases even from research being done abroad.
Wayne Pines?
There's basically a partnership between the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, and the pharmaceutical industry. The NIH does a lot of basic research, comes up with research that helps develop new drugs. And then almost exclusively, on a worldwide basis, the American pharmaceutical industry takes that research and actually develops the new product. A lot of those products, the vast, vast majority, and, you know, the numbers vary. Some say as many as 4,999 out of 5,000, never make it to market. There's a lot of research that goes on that, while it's productive in that it tells you it doesn't work, it's not productive in that it doesn't lead to a new drug. The drug industry spends about $30 billion a year on research. That's more than the NIH spends. The gap between what the industry spends and what the NIH spends has been increasing. Various political candidates have promised to increase NIH funding to double it. That hasn't happened, and so right now the industry spends the vast majority of money on research. If you cut back, if you have price controls, if you cut back on the strength of the pharmaceutical industry, then intrinsically you cut into the amount that's being spent on research, and you make the research priorities of the industry much, much more difficult. It doesn't mean that there won't be any research. That's the lifeblood of the industry. That's the lifeblood of medical progress. It has been for a century, but it will mean that some drugs that might be useful to some people simply will not be developed because the money isn't there.
Sure. Peter Stone, we've heard this argument before. Ralph Nader took it on in a report. What was that report? What did it say on this question of research, the NIH, and the drug company's claim about the coincidence of their interests with the broader public interest?
Well, I'm actually not familiar with the details of the Nader report, but I have talked to a number of experts on this area, including Arnold Relman, a professor emeritus at Harvard, who has recently argued that the drug company's claims of just how dangerous it would be to cut into that price controls could lead to a cut in R&D are vastly exaggerated. I mean, Relman and many other critics have argued that a large proportion of, and it's not clear just precisely how much, but a large proportion of industry development efforts are funded by NIH. And I don't think the industry has ever come up with any convincing figures that show precisely how much of their money is spent versus how much of NIH money is spent. But there is a definite connection between government funding of support for R&D and new drugs. Mm-hmm. And it's unclear to me, using the industry argument, that if there were some kind of price curbs, it's unclear to me that this would definitely mean a cutback in industry spending and R&D. And I think the industry has failed to make a convincing case that this would happen. Mm-hmm. After all, the main fact, another factor to keep in mind, is that industry profits, as you noted and we've talked about earlier this year, have been soaring in recent years. They're at almost four times the median for Fortune 500 companies. So whether some limitations on prices, and we're talking generalities here, so it's very hard to say just how much this would mean, but if some limitations on industry prices might not impact R&D at all.
Mm-hmm. Given the profit margin.
Can I just add a fact into the debate here?
Wayne Pines.
If you go back to the early part of the 90s, 1992, 1993, when the political candidates were beating up on the drug companies. So the drug companies always become controversial during political campaigns because people need targets. There was a lot of criticism. The price of the stock prices of the drug stocks dropped significantly, about 20%. What we saw then was a reaction in the R&D budgets, and the R&D budgets went down in a commensurate way. I mean, that's just a fact. But as I said before, there is a partnership between the NIH and the pharmaceutical industry. It's very, very clear how that's delineated. I don't think there should be any controversy about that. The NIH does a lot of basic research. Pharmaceutical industry obviously does as well. But the NIH doesn't have any capacity whatsoever for developing new products.
Right.
And
basic
that's what
research.
The pharmaceutical industry does.
Right. They do basic research. Darrell West, do you want to come in here?
What all of this tells me is the need for better disclosure of exactly what the costs are, because we have lots of competing claims about how much money actually goes into producing these drugs, how much does it cost them, if we had price controls, what impact would that have. We need better information, and I think at a minimum one thing Congress should consider is getting more information from the pharmaceutical industry, just so we could have a much more informed public debate on these very issues.
Right, thank you. Mark is on the line. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
Yeah, just right on the points that were just being made, I'm convinced that there is enough money on the table to both lower the price of these drugs, and by money on the table, I mean profits. It's been talked about. I mean, the pharmaceutical profit margins are so much higher than the rest of the sectors of the economy, even when you factor in the cost of the failure of all the drugs that don't make it to market. I think the incentive to continue to come up with new drugs will always be there because that's the future of their business. And because there are patents, and there's good reason to have patents, that prevents sort of normal market forces from working. So I think we as a society need to grapple with, you know, what is an acceptable level of profit for these companies to be making? Because ultimately, when the prices are high enough, it does mean that specific people cannot get the drugs they need to make themselves better. Mm-hmm. So there's a compelling societal interest that we all share to look at this squarely. And I don't think we can count on the pharmaceutical industry to come up with a satisfactory solution on their own.
Thanks, Mark. A point worth underscoring. On the other hand, we have Peter Drucker, who's a disinterested observer of business and has been for 50 years, who says that profits really are the cost of future business and that the whole notion of, you know, a rate of profit that is unwanted, somehow out of the ordinary, is naive, that today's profits are the cost of tomorrow's business, and that fixing on profits is not a profitable way to proceed if you're talking about capitalism. But thanks for the point. Kathy is on the line.
Can I make a point? I think we have to focus on the issue, and the issue is not profits. The issue is access. How do we assure that everybody has access to drugs? Just as how do we assure that everybody has access to hospitalization, to emergency rooms, to whatever health care they want? And what we have to do is deal with the access issue, not the profits issue.
Get more people covered.
Get more people covered by insurance plans that have worked very well. Again, that you and I have. We don't have any complaints, or at least I hope not, about the cost of pharmaceuticals because we're paying $5 or $10 a prescription. What we need to do is to take those kinds of plans, expand them, and if people cannot afford them, then have the government subsidize them. It's a fairly simple solution to the access problem.
We're glad to hear this emphasis on access. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Make the Pharma Lobby connection. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is The Connection. Connection listeners, are you spending too much on prescription drugs? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Scott is on the line. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
One thing that doesn't seem to have been mentioned here is what is this research actually paying for? What are we actually getting from this research? It seems that drug companies have created many needs, for example, for what I call vanity drugs. So, for example, toenail fungus. I mean, who knew?
There's a drug for toenail fungus?
That's right. And this actually raises – so on the one hand, there's creating a need for drugs that we didn't know we needed. But on the other hand, there's a larger public health issue of kids, for example, being overprescribed for Ritalin. If you took a snapshot of people on the street, how many have taken – some medication today, either prescription or over-the-counter, I think we might find that we're pretty over-medicated as a society. And the analogy is like the meatpacking industry where the herds are so – the cost per head is so high because the drugs themselves have created more needs. Antibiotics, for example, making us – we need stronger antibiotics. And
right.
I think we have to ask what this research is actually getting us. In some cases, the vanity stuff, and in the other cases, I think we're creating more problems than we're solving.
Of course, one man's vanity may be another man's toe fungus. What about this, Darrell West? Any response to this?
Well, it strikes me that, an interesting issue that Scott raises is all of the commercial advertising that's now being done for specific drugs and how that is contributing to the costs facing the drug companies and whether that is necessary in this type of situation, because you can essentially create artificial markets for drugs that otherwise there might not be that much consumer demand. So it really does relate very directly to this whole question of what are the costs of producing drugs versus the costs of marketing drugs.
I'd like to add one thing on that, Jack, too, because the studies that came out earlier this year that showed there was a 19% increase last year and the year before in spending on prescription drugs from an independent agency in Washington that monitors healthcare costs did indicate that so-called direct-to-consumer advertising, these TV ads, which have exploded the last couple of years for everything from Claritin to Viagra to a drug called Zocor, which is a cholesterol reducer, that these ads have been a contributing factor and in the big explosion in spending on prescription drugs. There are other concerns there, too, which have surfaced that we haven't raised that I think are worth mentioning, and that is the whole concern about disclosure of risks and benefits in these ads. These ads tend to be very feel-good, pretty ads, which show people dancing in fields and things like that. But there are real concerns that the ads, which are quick TV ads, don't adequately indicate costs, benefits, and risks to these drugs. Pete Stark of California has introduced a bill that would deny drug companies certain standard advertising tax deductions if their ads fail to present risks and benefits in a balanced fashion. Of course, Stark is a Democrat, a healthcare reformer who's long had, you know, strong views on the industry, but even the Federal Drug Administration is stepping up its monitoring of these television advertising. And just in the last couple of weeks, almost weekly, there's been a story in the Wall Street Journal or another publication indicating that the FDA has talked to drug companies, has advised drug companies that particular ads are not adequately talking about risks to new drugs.
Right, right.
And I think this is a concern with this mushrooming of so-called direct-to-consumer advertising.
Sure. Thank you, Scott. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anita is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hello.
Hello. My husband recently had an infection. It was Staph aureus. It was in the bone. And he tried many different drugs. The final drug that really worked, I presume, because he's better now, cost $2,400 a month, per month. He was ill for 6 months. Now, while he was in the hospital, of course, his health insurance covered it. When he was not, we paid for it.
Yeah.
Now, I want to know why a drug, even a new drug, should cost that much money.
Of course, it worked.
Of course, it worked.
Yeah.
But the point still is that that's an outrageous amount of money.
Right.
And the normal person could not have afforded to pay for it.
Indeed. Wayne Pines.
Well, let me address the. Can I address the earlier?
Well, let's stick to this one let's stick to this one and get on with it.
Because there's one important point. During the break, there was an ad for a show coming up on Fresh Air, and what it said was that the show was going to be entirely about new cancer drugs. Now there's a new optimism with regard to the treatment of cancer. To me, that's the response to a lot of the questions about cost. The shows about all the new cancer drugs don't talk about the issues we're talking about today. What they talk about is the optimism that has developed because of all the research that's going on. And that research is coming from the pharmaceutical industry, from the biotech industry.
Of course, but optimism isn't going to help Anita with this $2,400 a month bill.
I don't know what the drug is. The fact is that the drug did work. What we need to do is to be sure that people like Anita and her husband have the kind of insurance coverage that will cover those kinds of costs. Right now, we don't have it. And that's what the industry has been advocating for a long time, and that is that we have insurance that covers that. I don't know what the hospital bill was. I'm sure the hospital bill was much higher. And I'm sure that Anita is very pleased that her husband is cured. So the issue is not what the cost is. The issue is really how do we make sure that everybody can afford to have the drugs that they need and to get them in an appropriate way.
Anita, any response?
Yes.
Go ahead.
This is considered a designer drug. Do you know what a designer drug is? It means that it is not frequently used. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it is extremely expensive. Now, that's because the drug companies insist that because they make only a smaller amount of these particular kind of drugs, they have to charge more for them.
Well, that's simple. That's the way the economic system works. If you have a one-of-a-kind product that is exclusively made for you, then you're going to be paying a premium.
It's not that made exclusively. It's used throughout the world.
We can't get into the particulars of that drug,
exactly.
but we certainly see the logic here. And
Jack, this is I'd like to just
Peter Stone,
throw in one other example that has that's somewhat analogous to this question, and that is the battle that's been going on over AIDS medications around the world. I mean, the industry side, its problems at home with high drug costs, has faced a onslaught of criticism in Africa and third world countries because of the high prices for its AIDS medications. Typically, the retrovirals that are used to fight AIDS cost $10,000 to $15,000 for a 1 year supply per patient. An Indian drug company has been making the same product for about $500, and in recent months, after a long period of criticism from activists, international organizations, and the media, I think, too, played a role in this, several big drug companies have agreed under pressure to lower their prices from $10,000 to $15,000 a year to cut them about 90% for many AIDS patients in Africa. This was a hard decision for the industry, obviously, but it also reflects, in some ways, the true manufacturing cost of these medications. Mm-hmm.
The manufacturing as against research costs. Thank you, Anita. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Caller from Boston. Hello.
Hello.
Richard.
Hello, this is Richard Lang. I'm at the Boston University School of Public Health.
Yes.
And I'd just like to draw to the attention that the point that was made that price controls have never worked. The Australian Productivity Commission have just completed and published a survey which looked at 150 leading drugs used in their system, which is very similar to the American system. And they showed that the US was paying 2.6 times as much as Australia. Canada was paying 1.5 times as much. The UK, 1.5 times as much. Sweden, 1.5. France, 1.1. Spain, exactly the same. And New Zealand, 0.9.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point to make is that the US companies, this 2.6 is way out of whack with the rest of the OECD countries. All of those countries have some form of price control. It varies in different environments.
Has it stifled innovation and research?
As far as development of new drugs are concerned, it doesn't seem to have, because we have very viable industries, particularly in the European countries. And when we say stifling research, we should remember that most of the companies are multinational companies. They take their profits wherever they can throughout the world. And many of the large companies, who are enormous, have subsidiaries throughout the world and work in that way. The other point to make is most of the companies, their profits are about three times as much as their research and development costs are. Merck in 1999 only spent 6.3% of revenues on research, and their profits at the same time was 18%.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Pines?
Well, you say that the drug industries are strong in those countries. I'd challenge you to name a single drug that has been developed in Australia, in Canada, or in any of the other, in Sweden, or in any of the other countries with price controls. Certainly they can get a handle on the amount that they're spending for existing drugs. But no new drugs come out of those pipelines because there is no significant medical research that's going on in any of those countries because they have price controls. And so you have to establish that direct correlation between pricing, price controls, and medical progress and medical research.
Yeah.
That's where the flaw is.
Mm-hmm.
certainly in this country, we can reduce the price of drugs by having price controls. We're also going to affect the amount that's being spent on research, and we're going to affect medical progress. And I don't think that that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think one of the key things, the key findings that this Australian study brought out was that for originator drugs, new drugs in a class, they showed that the price differentials were far less. But what other countries have managed to do is particularly target the Me Too products that have been produced to enter a field that already has an originator drug, and a new company will come in and produce a drug with that does exactly the same, has no benefit, invest in the marketing rather than the research to produce those drugs. And by controlling the cost of the Me Too drugs, you may well have a greater benefit on preserving the advantage of the originator company who have done the backbreaking research to bring a new class of drugs to the market.
Right. Well, in the United States, on
thank
average...
Thank you, Professor Lang.
I'm sorry.
Thanks for your call. Let's just wrap up here, Peter Stone. What's going to happen with this Medicare drug benefit? And more particularly, what we haven't talked about, what's going to happen with the extension of patents for brand-name drugs that will prevent cheaper generics from coming on the market sooner? What's going to happen there?
Well, let's start with the Medicare prescription mm-hmm. drug benefit. I think, you know, the industry had really hoped, as did many people in Congress, that there might be some bills introduced before the August recess. And in a very practical way down here in Washington, the fact that nothing has been introduced thus far is likely to mean that this issue is going to have a hard time getting addressed this year. And I think the feeling is that if it goes into next year, it could become a political football again, as it did in the last campaign, with both sides sort of pointing fingers at each other. I think that unless there's a lot of momentum very soon, and I don't see that really happening. There will be a lot of talk in the fall. There will be bills introduced, but the time is running out here for this year. And I think it's going to be tough to get something done this year, as you know many
sure.
really hoped.
Darrell West,
I think there are big divisions, too, mm-hmm. over the size of the benefit. I think that needs to be emphasized, mm-hmm. how big the benefit will be. I think that Republicans and Democrats, while there's some moderate Democrats who are in favor of some of the Republican proposals, such as John Breaux, I think that there are big ideological differences here over
sure.
whether this should be privately managed or government contractor, not government run, but government contractor.
Good point. Thank you, Peter Stone. Special thanks today to my guest, Darrell West, professor of political science at Brown University, Peter Stone, staff reporter for the National Journal, and Wayne Pines, a consultant to pharma. We had help today from Kim Bishari, Darren Mnuchin, and Tim Monroe. Our intern is Jack O'Boyce. The Connection is produced by Graham Smith with Sean Carberry, Sarah Fields, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, Karen Schiffman, and Doug Shugerts. Our senior producer today is Tara Murphy. To continue the power politics of the pharmaceutical industry Connection, you can go to our website, theconnection.org. I'm Jack Beatty. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR.